and I could do so well. But I never got punctured anywhere where I should have been. Huh? That was one, and yet it was a strict process. Very strict. Missouri Synod is strict. We're conservative. But already we begin to see what the slippage is. And shape of the communion announcement. Now, this is very complicated, and I'm not going to go into it too much here. If you have an interest, we can do this at one of the clutching times. See, one of the things that I have tried to do as a pastoral theologian is I have tried to split private confession and absolution from communion announcement for at least three reasons. Number one, if you've got 1,500 communicants, you can celebrate the Lord's Supper only about every 3 months, because it takes you that long to get through if you're going to have private confession and absolution for everybody. Secondly, if you want to celebrate every week and insist that everybody come every week, you can be sure you're going to start getting cock and bull stories. People are going to make up things, got to say something. Oh, I had one woman, Roman Catholic, became a Lutheran, and she was niggling about this private confession and absolution. She didn't grumbling about it. I said, that's all right. You'll find time. You'll get time. And I said, but you did that when you were a papist, didn't you? Yes. I said, what did you tell the priest? She said, oh, I always make up all kinds of things. I would never tell him anything. And the third thing is, I want to anchor private confession and absolution as the practice of the baptismal life. Its theological anchorage is in holy baptism, not in the Holy Eucharist. Now, I don't mean by that it's inappropriate to have confession and absolution as one of the modes for your examining the individual life of individual members. But you're examining their life in preparation for the Lord's Supper is not the same thing as coercing them to confession. You may not do that. You may not coerce them to make confession. Now, there's one qualifying mark on that. From the time of my ministry, many early years, nobody became a member of the congregation by adult baptism through catechesis or by renewal and confession of faith or by confirmation. Nobody became confirmed a member until at least once private confession and absolution. So I always had a whole group of people that had the experience at least once. And I grounded that in August in Apology 24. And Apology 24 can be interpreted in different ways. But we do not serve until someone's been examined and absolved. That's the grounds for that. So the question now, I don't want to tangle that up with a debate about whether we should have private confession and absolution as the mode of individual communion announcements. Nor do I want to make some sort of ritual for individual communion announcements. I'm talking about the pastoral care of the men and women and children who participate at the altar, where you are the episcopus, you are the watchman, that they receive this with great benefit. Now, that's what Maurer is about. I'll go back to Maurer now. Maurer comments on the 19th century attempts made to reestablish some kind of discipline for participation in the Lord's body and blood. Klaus Harms made the attempt in Schleswig-Holstein. Theodor Kleefoth and Theodosius Harnack, both academicians as well as preachers, attempted through preaching and practice to try to individualize the general confession. You know, the Swedish, well, the Scandinavian custom is there's a general confession and individual absolution. There have been all kinds of devices tried. But according to Maurer, and I concur with Maurer, I depend on him and I also make an independent judgment. According to Maurer, Wilhelm Lea is the only one who established a continuing practice for his congregation and for the deaconess house, the Diakonissen Anstalt. This is due, says Maurer, chiefly that Lea so clearly as no other longed for and found the cleft, the power in the divine word of grace of holy absolution. So that this, now, we're coming around to what we're doing here. Maurer goes on to talk about Gerhard von Sesewich, who was a great catechist. He was a student of Leah's and a great catechist at the University of Erlangen. Proposed that private communion announcements would furnish an opportunity for what von Sesewich called pastoral conversation. And with that pastoral conversation, that's the question I asked you, would lead into persönliche Beichte, personal or individual Beichte, confession. And then that would include absolution. That was von Sesewich. He was a catechist. You can expect that from an educator. That's good that we have good educators. The experiments, however, have all miscarried, according to Maurer. However, one demand or challenge, Forderung, of von Sesewich, which has established itself, and those students who have studied private confession and absolution with me have heard this. Unalterably, the pastor who wants to carry out the office of father confessor must himself have experienced the blessings of the absolution in a personal persönlichen Beichtverhältnis, or a personal confessional relationship. I say to the students, if you're going to hear confession, don't touch it unless you are a penitent under some pastor, somebody else that hears yours. So the question is now, I read this thing from Maurer and expatiated on it for 10 minutes. I read this because I want you to try to understand. Now, please humor me if necessary. What I think I'm doing is I'm rebuilding old and good things that have slipped away. I'm not an innovator. I'm not a reformer. I'm not ahead of a movement. The only movement I really am concerned about is regularity of bowel movement. That's the only one I really bother about. I don't want to be the head of any movement. But I do, now I think what I do want to say is I want to rebuild. And that's what Paul calls edifying. And that has come clearer to me. And I, at least that's how I see it. Now you may say, well, he doesn't see very well. He's myopic when it comes to his, and like Augustine, I say, what am I? I don't really know myself. Now, if you want to respond to that, we will. Otherwise, it'll be just about, my clock has 4 minutes yet, Peter. Pastor, where's Pat? He's hiding. Do you have any comments you want to make on this? We'll pick up for comments again. You are free to make comments or ask questions or make criticisms if you'd like.
Can you comment on the person to whom the pastor confesses and receives absolution in terms of the persons outside the congregation, any certain counselor?
For the pastors, that's my recommendation. There is a great deal of fear about that. And with good reason. But that's my recommendation, that it be the circuit counselor. And most pastors feel about, many of the students I've had, what have I had? Maybe 200 students over the years on this matter. Of the students that I've had, a large number of them are afraid because they don't trust the circuit counselor. And I say to them quite simply, now you know why your people don't come to you. They don't trust you. And that's one of the problems we've got. It's a real problem. And my counsel is not very good on that. So what? You know, take your guts in your hand and do it. And if the counselor betrays you or doesn't know what his own job is, teach him. And because it's all going to be known in Judgment Day anyway, you know, so don't get too uptight about it. But Wallenberg, George, President Wallenberg thinks it's no longer assigned to the circuit counselor constitutionally. So Wallenberg doesn't quite agree with this. Wallenberg thinks that if the circuit counselor and the circuit agree on it, then it can be done. He's, bless him, he's a good constitutional man, and we need him. I am very opposed to the mendicant monks. You know what the mendicant monks were? Pastor Bugenhagen and Luther were pastors, St. Mary's Church. They knew who came to the sacrament. And when the prince got drunk and they knew about it, they talked to the prince before he came to the sacrament. So, sometimes people didn't want to go to them. Now, the monks would come through town. They'd listen to your confession for 2 bits. And next morning, they'd be gone. Well, everybody wanted to go there because they didn't have to live with the guys. And they never knew what the outcome of this absolution was. And this has been a very important thing for me because from the beginning of my ministry, people in the city just transfer willy-nilly. They get mad at the pastor or the organist. They just transfer somewhere else. And I think, how can this be? And the same way, you don't like a pastor, go transfer to another congregation where you get a good preacher. And go around, whimper your story to the circuit counselor or the district president and all about somebody or some brother, and we listen to it. I mean, we got dozens of those cases going on. And I'm opposed to all of that. And one way to stop that, I think, is you stop it where you can. So I don't go with the go around and find a brother that you want. God bless you if you have a good friend. Bless you. Find a brother. You can drink a beer with, talk over your trubbies. Wonderful. Pray together, sing together, fight together, play golf together. But don't confuse that with being a father confessor. Somebody who's watching out for your soul, to whom you at least have the chance of coming close to telling the truth about yourself. Was there... You've been very good. You must have had easy days.
You can talk for about 7 more minutes.
What?
No,
it's 8 o'clock.
They ran late because
of
the rain. So,
oh.
I got to work. If you don't want to go to 7 more minutes, that's fine too. You're wound up to stop right now.
Are we going to be talking about the slippage when it comes to examination being part of pastoral care?
Examination of the penitent, or?
And of ourselves. Oh,
yes, I have 7 minutes, I can do that easily. I don't know when this will come. My first talk about it was with President Bowman, president of the seminary in St. Louis, and the sainted Robert Preuss, president of Fort Wayne Seminary. And I have talked about it with my bishop, Bishop Patelko. And I've talked about it everywhere anybody will give me an audience. And I thank you for opening the door. Talked about it in Northern Illinois with Pastor, the old man who had to retire, Letch. Well, he was there. There are three things that must happen. Number one, we must strip the seminaries of authorizing the ordination, the candidates for ordination. The seminary must be declared incompetent to do this. It's not their business. It's not that they don't know, but they've got some things to do, secondly, that we want to examine. We want to know how these guys come out of there. What is the shape of the candidates that are coming out of there? And that examination, thirdly, has to be done by the bishops, the district presidents, and by a godly council of pastors and mature men and women from the laity, of a district or a circuit. They are the ones who have to examine. That examination ought to go on for about a week. And they are the ones who will declare he is worthy to be ordained. Now, Bowman and Preuss at that time were absolutely uninterested. That's taking big turf away from them. And yet, we got kind of a hypocritical hangover. Who signed your document for ordination? Who signed it? Who signed yours? At least you're honest, Chad. No seminary person signed that. It's the DP. That's a hangover. The only one who can really say that you're worthy to be ordained is the bishop of that district. When I asked the Illinois, I said, Pastor, finally, who signed yours? Well, it was kind of a quizzical, sort of a Quaker meeting went on. Who did? I don't know. And then I said, President Letch, why do you sign him? Do you know him? He's a gracious old man. He said, gee, I don't know, but I do it pretty. I have met one district president who was examined by a district president. One of those who was expelled by President Preuss, Emil Jake, was president of the Northwest District. He told me in 1976, I had a series of lectures with the district presidents on ordination, authority, canonicity, inspiration. President Jake told me that, I think he was ordained in Wyoming, that he was examined by his district president before he was ordained. And I've never found another one. I ask every time. And my district president didn't even know who I was. I was English district. Bartels was down in Ohio, or I think, somewhere. And I was up in Minnesota. He didn't know me from Adam. Now, how are we going to do this? I don't have the foggiest idea. I'm not prepared to do this for memory. President Patelko, we called him Bishop, and I like that. And he did not have circuit counselors. He still had visitors, which is the Latin word for episcopoi. Asked me to do a gutachten for him on licensing, when lay ministers became licensed to do things that pastors do, play church. The study that I did was from Walther, not the Reader's Digest Walther that's come out from Christian News, but the full Walther. And there are several pages on the examination. And Walther knows nothing of the seminary doing this, nothing. And has all kinds of things about the examination. Who may not be there because of vested interest, or they may have, you know. And it's really quite good. I think it's great. And then, as a matter of curiosity, I checked the Reader's Digest version of Walther's Pastoral Theology, the John H.C. Fritz one, and I got to that section. It's reduced to a footnote. Well, it's about 8 pages, and Walther said, of course, we don't have to worry about this because the seminaries take care of this now. It's kind of cute.
Well, aren't they trying to make it some kind of an attempt then, at least before you get to go to school, examine you before you go to school?
Formally, it's there. You're supposed to have a letter from your pastor. Huh?
But now you have to go in front of a couple of tables of laity and pastors and district representatives.
Where?
Every person before they go into the seminary.
Really?
Well, and before you go to the medical college, doesn't that have to be
done? I didn't know this. This is new to me. It's new to me.
Yeah, it's been going on for a couple of years.
Yeah.
About 4 years.
Oh, I didn't know this.
But the question that they're asking is if you're going to be suited to be a pastor, but you haven't even gone to a class.
Yeah.
Well,
it is an extension of what has become a substitute. The substitute is the battery of psychological examinations now. And what you're describing is an extension of that. They are not concerned about the the psychological ones are not concerned about the spiritual life and the character of this person. May the words of our mouths and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. I want to say some miscellaneous things. Peter, thank you for that matins this morning. As a young pastor, when we started praying matins every morning in the church, a lot of complaint was about all the time it took. Where are you going to get all that time? Twice in my life, I have been irritated into using a stopwatch. And that was one time this morning, I don't know when we began, but according to my calculation, we were there 15 minutes. Now, 15 minutes out of a day, if people don't have time for that, then I tell you, you are too busy. You better learn how to take a Sabbath or a rest someplace. And it was that way in St. Paul. I thought finally, 12 to 15 minutes, and we would have three psalms, two readings, and a hymn like we had this morning. Secondly, Peter, it would be a marvelous idea for everybody to have a tape of this, of the men singing and the women singing. That was so beautiful, singing a cappella. That tape could be given to the homes of the family. See, you can do that at home. I'm going to talk a little bit later about what you do with the disciplining of the families in the home for their catechetical study and prayer life. But it has always seemed so preposterous to me that we expected families, fathers and mothers, to think up something creative and inventive and new every day or every week, years on end, when the pastors themselves can't do it for the liturgical service. And that when they start getting inventive, in 1 year they're repeating themselves over and over and over, the same stale old stuff. That's the punishment we get for abandoning the liturgy. But the second one was when we started celebrating at the chapel. The year that I joined the Valparaiso University was the year that we began to use the Chapel of the Resurrection, and my responsibility was the services for daily prayer and the Sunday services, although they were under the aegis of Emmanuel and the pastors at Emmanuel. They had the work for the services done at the chapel, and there was so much that we didn't know where we were dealing with large numbers of people, and there were 75 communicants per service that could gather around the altar. And I finally had the Department of Engineering take a stopwatch and time every single thing we did so that we could find out where to cut time. That's just the one thing. Secondly, Pastor, without any kind of criticism on anything for any of you, I have always found it just a little bit scatterbrained and hasty and unmanageable for me to go, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God of Sabaoth." That is an awesome thing that we are saying there. And if you read Isaiah 6 and brood on Isaiah 6, it seems to me it would be much better to develop a kind of slow cadence. Holy, holy, holy Lord God. It gives you some time. It gives me some time, at least. And that I like. For cocktail conversation, a miscellaneous that you wanted, never wanted, you always wanted to know and were always afraid to ask. But thou, O Lord, have mercy upon us, goes back at least to the 10th century, in which at the reading of the monasteries at mealtime, the abbot would sit in his little place and somebody would be assigned to be the reader. While the monks ate, they were supposed to listen to readings from the scripture or from the fathers. And when the abbot saw that monks were beginning to lose interest, they lost attention and started nodding because they just had their poverty, excellent meal of poverty and good wine. And then he would say, "But thou," and that was a word to the reader to stop reading, "but thou." And then the word was, "O Lord, have mercy on us." Somehow or another, that slipped in, that rubric slipped into the antiphon. "But thou, O Lord, have mercy." So you will see in the new hymnals, it's just, "O Lord, have mercy upon it." Somebody along the line discovered this. I will be talking specifically about the shape and the content of the offices when we, as part of our conversation on prayer later today, later this morning. So I shan't say anything more about it. Except I'll probably repeat this at somewhere down the line. I was reminded this morning of our quarrels about the hymnals and all of that stuff. And I am not addressing myself to that except in a later footnote. But the idea, the discipline of having a canon of morning hymns, of evening hymns, a canon that everybody in the congregation sings, everybody, if they can't sing, that they read them like poems, includes this, O splendor of God's glory bright. Two of them that have no peer, O splendor of God's glory bright, and O holy blessed Trinity, divine eternal unity, are absolutely exquisite. We sang that yesterday in the divine service. It's just marvelous, marvelous. There are so many of them that you really can have one for each day of the week. But two of them that are exquisite, and neither of them found its way into Lutheran worship. And O splendor of God's glory bright was mutilated in Lutheran worship. It was mutilated by a woman who should know better. She's Gracia Grindel, who teaches pastoral theology at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. Herself a poet, an expert in English, and a good teacher. The hymn just got messed up, just botched. But these two songs, 539, Come Thou Bright and Morning Star, the most exquisite melody for morning singing. And it is absolutely a hymn laden with stuff for meditation. There are frequently times when it takes me 25 minutes to sing that hymn, simply because of the way it opens up things for prayer and meditation. And splendid, splendid tune. And the other one is God who, 4549, God who made the earth and heaven, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. In case I forget it later, but I hope I don't. I'm going to say it now, then I'll repeat it if I remember it later. Help me as the morn is breaking, in the spirit to arise. No. Let the night of my transgression with night's darkness pass away. For meditation on daytime, sunrise, light, darkness. The darkness around us. Jesus, into your possession, I resign myself today. In your wounds I find relief. I always have the congregations, unless they're alone, I always have the congregations and myself sing that in the plural. In your wounds we find relief from all sorrow, sin, and grief. On Friday particularly, but many times other days, Friday, the crucifixion day, the meditation on the wounds of Jesus. Let your wounds stand open is what the German says. In your wounds I find relief. That theme of meditating on the crucifix, the wounds of Jesus, and your own sin in relation to those very wounded instruments. I mean, he was circumcised, he was crowned with thorns, he was mocked, he was nailed to the cross, he was stuck with a spear. The ways that we do sin, and in those wounds we find relief. That's another one of those hymns. It may take you 20 or 30 minutes to sing it if you use it as a starter for your own reflection and your own intercession. But what I want to say, and I will be saying that again when we talk about meditation and prayer, is the development, the disciplined development for you and for your congregations to have a canon of hymnody. There ought to be at least 50 major hymns for the Sundays of the church year, and another 35 or so that are for the special times and special occasions. And the treasuring of a hymn book by the members of the family. All the members of the family ought to have a hymn book. Everybody. That would be a good thing for the Ladies' Aid to give, or the voters to spend some money on. Everybody gets a hymn book. Like everybody's got a Bible. And everybody's got a catechism. But the treasury of the hymnal and that use of it, and that takes some discipline. It takes long, single-minded discipline on the part of the pastor. And I don't know what has happened to us exactly, but I do know that in my own training and the ethos in which I grew up, the only hymn that made any difference, really, was the sermon hymn. And the pastor always picked the sermon hymn according to what he was going to talk about in the sermon. Now, that wasn't so bad if he were sticking strictly with the pericopes and staying in conformity with what was going on in the church's year. But the dominance of the sermon hymn is a new dominance, at least in within my lifetime. The old pattern was the hymn of the day. And that, I think, is worthy of rebuilding, that hymn of the day process. So much for the miscellaneous things. You want to comment? You can talk back anytime you'd like. I ended yesterday with talking to you about Wilhelm Maurer and what he was asking about, can we rebuild the building, the edifice, with the discipline related to participation in the Lord's body and blood and the sacrament. And for Maurer, this was connected with private confession and absolution. The title of the article that I was quoting from is called Die Pietismus und das Einzelbeichte. That was an article. The damage that pietism did to this practice. But at the time of Bach, yet in Leipzig, 1750, Bach died, the practice of private confession was widespread. You can read the lists of the people who went to confession, 200, 300, 400 in each of the churches on a Sunday morning, or whenever they had confession, before the Sunday service. And between that time and what Maurer is concerned about, the attempt to revive this in the 19th century, and what I call the slippage of the belt, the disintegration of this that has happened. And Maurer talked about various people, Kleefoth, Theodosius Harnack, Harms, attempting to reestablish this. And Maurer said Leah really was the only one who succeeded in doing this in any continuing basis. It's still the practice in Nikolaikirche and in Neuendettelsau, and they have reestablished it. I was in Neuendettelsau in 1996 and spent 4 or 5 days there with the deaconesses, and they have reestablished. They have a list of the confessors who are going to be in the church and at what times are going to be there for the sisters and the members of the Christian community that are associated with the diaconate. Leah, he says, Maurer says, was able to sustain this because the center for him was he had learned the blessing and the power of individual absolution, of that absolution spoken to the penitent. Now, Maurer's, I went on to say last night, and this is where we ended and where we're going to begin today, Maurer, at the end of this article, has a kind of pathetic little paragraph, and yet it is a most splendid little paragraph. I don't know where I got this. One day after a class session on confession and absolution privately, some student handed a Xerox copy of this article to me, and I can't remember who it was. If it was one of you, I want to thank you for it. At the end of that, he said, how are we going to go about this? And then he says, what we must do is we must find some old man who has the authority and the experience, and he will meet with the young pastors and he will train them and teach them. And this student said, we found him, handed it to me. Now, I don't know. I don't appoint myself as being an old man who is the one that's wise and experienced. I have studied and I've practiced what I'm telling you I've practiced for before I was a graduate from the seminary, when I made my confession to one of the professors, a very dangerous thing to do, and I didn't realize it at the time. But you have asked me, and I have been asked by proper people in authority, to teach and talk about this. And whether at the end of my life today with you, I had thought I would like to sing like a swan, because this may be a swan song. If I end up cackling like a crow, let God be glorified. Let God be magnified. Amen. So I'm talking about episcopal governance now, and today I'm going to talk about episcopal governance, and I'm going to talk about taking heed to yourselves from the point of view of what Jesus says to those pastors or to those people to whom he gives the care of his flock. When I say Episcopal, I am deliberately trying to induce a semantic crisis, because we have gotten to the point where you could call an acolyte a ham sandwich and it wouldn't make any difference. We don't know what the words are anymore. We use the word bishop. The vicar calls his pastor the bishop. Now, I think he's right. But the congregation couldn't think of it that way. They said, oh, my God, he's going Romanizing on us, or some such things. We call our district presidents bishop, and most of them want to be chief executive officers. Many of them want to be chief executive officers. When I talked to my friend who was driven out of the Missouri Synod, Dr. Lawrence Needing, who is became a professor at the Philadelphia Seminary, a fine New Testament exegete, a classmate of mine at the seminary, when he heard that they were going to call the Elka men bishops, he said, God have mercy on us. They'll take their courses in CPE, and they'll come out and counsel with all of us. And then we really will be messed up. So spare us. Do you want the title? Remember my question yesterday? Do you want the title or the task? What do you want? Now, in terms of the words, I think pastor is probably the best word. But I have been trying to get some words that are sticking. And I'm going to keep spitting in the wind, because in another 25 years, this is the way it will be. I can promise you on that. Not because I have any control, but because I simply know that this is going to come. So that when we talk about the pastor, episcopus, visitor is the old Latin word. He comes to look at you. It's a very old thing. Paul sent Timothy and Titus around to see how things were going in the churches. It's a wonderful thing. And any of you who have ever had an old-time visitor come to visit you, it was a remarkable as well as a terrifying experience. When I would go and call on the people when I was elected a visitor, that was really the only office I ever wanted in the Synod beyond being a pastor in the congregation. When I would visit them, there would be a whole series of things that would go on. There would be about 3 days. I would listen. I would want their sermons. I want copies of their sermons. I would want to talk about their church records. I'd want to talk about their study life. I wanted to see what books they were reading. I wanted to be available to them as a father confessor. I also said, if your wife wants to talk to a pastor outside of you, I will be available to make an appointment with her. That coming to see. Then I would talk with the elders, with the voters assembly, with families, catechumens, see what's going on there. That is a marvelous thing. Part of our problem is that every one of us is a soloist. And the way things have become since the Civil War in the 1960s, we're playing things very close to the chest, because we're not going to trust anybody with what's going on. Just do what you have to do. Do your own thing. Sounds like judges, doesn't it? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And nobody ever looks. And we don't want anybody snooping around, because when they start snooping, they don't come as episcopoi, pastors, or as visitors who are going to nurture us and correct us and sustain us and guide us and foster us and edify us. So that this is the one thing. Secondly, colleagues, I'm going to divert for just a little bit. This is what I mean by the pastor. I'm going to divert for just a little bit to talk about the presbyterate. It is not a canonical requirement of Holy Scripture that a pastor be a seminary graduate. I don't debunk the seminary or the seminary graduation. I think they are blessed institutions, human institutions. They're not divine. Human institutions that have a very good purpose. The problem is they have become magisterial, as if they were the episcopoi of the church. They are not. They are not qualified to decide who is worthy to be ordained and who isn't. That should be the church. But nevertheless, not every preacher or pastor needs to be a seminary graduate. Secondly, in Holy Church and in the Lutheran Church's tradition, and a very good tradition by human development, a very good tradition, the way you become a pastor is you are ordained. That's how you become a pastor. This licensing bit, that is always part of the freaking out of the church. Walther says, yeah, those licensing people, they get the feathers of the Holy Spirit, then they take off and go in whatever heresy they want. the licensing, and then you, every 3 years you apply to the Bureau for your license again, and if you haven't been selling the good brew, then you don't get the license anymore. That's a whole, is to be rejected. That, and I'm glad that Synod has sobered up and is saying, we're going to stop that licensing bit. But you can become a pastor in the Lutheran Church without being a seminary graduate, but you must be ordained. And this is what I would like to use the title presbyterate, because we are in a position, we now have 600 plus vacancies. We have places like Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church in Chicago. When they asked me to take care of them, they couldn't have paid the moving bill if they'd called me, let alone a salary. They couldn't have, Center City churches simply, in many instances, can't make it. The ones that make it are the ones that have everybody coming in from the suburbs yet and keeping them alive. They don't make it out of what's going on in there. And that's part of our dilemma. We have talked about money, and we think about money in such ways that we're caught in a corner right now. And the squeeze in Synod is getting tighter and tighter and tighter. Not because there's less money, there's more money. But the presbyterate then would be those who are ordained pastors that are not seminary graduates. They would be canonically limited to the congregation that ordained them. They are not on the call to any other congregation anywhere. If they go, they have ceased functioning as a presbyter, unless another congregation calls them and ordains them in that place. Canonically, then, they are under the pastor. And the episcopus, if it's still possible, episcopus ought always to be learned, God-fearing, and pious. That is, a seminary graduate. Isn't that how you describe seminary graduates? Learned, God-fearing, pious?
Ideally.
Yes. Oh, I don't live in an ideal world.
Humble.
They consider it no blessed sprite that they were born to set the church right. That's from Franzman. That's not original with me. Secondly, the presbyterate would be, the presbyter would be a pastor in the full sense. George Wallenberg niggles on this. He says they ought not be allowed to confirm. And then I pressed Wallenberg. Are they to be allowed to absolve individually? Well, he doesn't think so. So a man like Dr. Wallenberg, and he's a good man, a formidable man. He's not to be taken lightly. I don't agree with him on this, but he's not to be taken lightly. The presbyter then would be a full pastor, and he would be canonically bound not only to his ordination vows, but canonically bound under the episcopus. And then the third thing is the diaconate, and this ought to be male and female. Once upon a time, I had a dream when I was appointed director of the Youth Leadership Training Program at Valparaiso University with the explicit orders to kill it. So that meant it would last for 5 years until the students who had entered had contractually been completed in the training course. 4 year baccalaureate plus 1 year internship. And when I was given that order to kill it, that was in 1969. That meant that by 1975, it was to have been terminated. That, my contact with the Lutheran Deaconess Association, for a period of time, I had served as the interim director between the death of Krentz and the coming of Arne Christo to become the director. In fact, you want to look at me, I'm kind of a dinosaur about things that have gone on. I once sat with the Council of Presidents when we made placements of graduates and vicars, because that's how we placed the deaconesses. And so I was the guy who knew about the deaconesses. They wanted my advice there when it came to a time to assigning them. Can you believe that? Strange how things change. The diaconate, what I tried to push was that the Lutheran Deaconess Association would go into some kind of federation with Valparaiso University and develop a diaconal program that was for men and women. Now, I wanted finally to submerge the so-called youth leadership training program under a process of diaconate. There is money that the LDA, Lutheran Deaconess Association, has, gifts that have been made over the years. They have quite a nest egg. And I propose that what we do is use that to develop a center for advanced study of the diaconate by deaconesses. I had one woman who should have had a PhD in systematics. There was no doubt about it. She did an honors paper for me that the St. Louis faculty said we would give her an STM for that paper. She was a brilliant woman. Finally crushed as a deaconess, though, and gone. But to get deaconesses and deacons who would become the experts to teach catechesis, the diaconal life, all of the things that go with the diaconate, including all of the variety of services that the congregation offers. So I said what we would do then, and this was the one point, we would ordain people to the diaconate. Right away, my wife is the chief critic on this. She's just opposed to this idea. She's opposed to the ordaining presbyters. But not everybody agrees, therefore. I want you to know that. Not everybody agrees. But the ordination to the diaconate, so that we could have musicians, youth ministers, directors of evangelism, directors of spiritual gift, directors of inreach, directors of outreach, directors of janitorial services, directors of church lighting. We could have all those directors in the diaconate. That would take care of the IRS, take care of your income tax. Everything would be taken care of. Well, I didn't get that through. It was killed. The university wanted to kill the YLTP, and that's what we did. But for a year, I had concentrated on this and doing the research and the study on the diaconate. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. Now, I all started this out by saying I'm going to talk about episcopal governance. I'm talking about now how the pastor governs the congregation. You will govern the congregation the way you think you are governed by Christ. You can take that as a kind of apodictic statement. It is apodictic. You will govern the congregation the way you think you are governed by Christ, or the way you believe you are governed by Christ. So that when I talk about governance here, I'm not talking about power. One of the things in my life that I have tried assiduously to avoid, I have not gotten into the political battles. I don't care a farthing about them. And I tried to get theologians out of the political battles. The thing that was solved, the Civil War that was solved politically, is still a problem with us because it's a theological issue, not a political issue. I'm not talking about politics. I'm not talking about how you practice leadership so that you can maneuver people to do what you want.